Well, at the moment, the idea of a thermonuclear or tactical nuke war seems to be not in the front page headlines anymore. We'll see. It could just take an hour and it's right back. So don't put it on the shelf and forget about it. We're really in deep trouble here. Not a joke. I just don't know how much more restraint Putin is going to be able to give out. The people over there cannot be happy. They've lost, I'm sure, at least 100,000 dead young Russian men and some women. Not okay. Now, that's not as bad as Ukraine, which has lost over 1 million dead men and women. But nonetheless, Russia is doing well. The military-industrial complex in that country is booming. But the people, they're asking. I'm sure they're asking. I was told by a friend who is no longer with us that people were becoming concerned. Why isn't this over? Why can't Russia, with the world's greatest military, steamroll Ukraine? And the answer is partly because Ukraine is being bankrolled by American taxpayers, by certainly the NATO countries and so forth. But still, this has gone on too long. There's still Ukrainian troops holding fairly significant pieces of the Donbass, which have never been freed as yet by Russia. Now, that's the part of Ukraine that declared it was no longer part of Ukraine, and it was now Russian. And that was legal. That was quite legal, quite legitimate. But there's still Ukrainians holding parts of Donbass. It boggles the mind when you think about it. Okay, let's go to our guest this hour, our friend Mitchell Henderson, and find out what's up with him. We're into some really interesting material. We started last time. It's kind of part two tonight. Hello, Mitch. Welcome back.
Hello. Good to be here.
Yes,
let me start off by just saying something about what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. Okay, so
yeah.
Ukraine has made many invasions, many offensives, or counteroffensives.
Yes.
Okay, but
yes.
I want everybody to understand, and if you understand this, you'll understand the absolute abject stupidity of NATO commanders in the United States military. Okay, so here we go. If I was going to make an offensive, there's certain things I want. You got to have your troops. You got to have some armor. You got to have your troops. But the key thing is you have to have supporting field artillery and supporting air support. Okay, and this is in addition to logistics and stuff. Okay. Even
those
a year
are mandatory.
Ago, even
you have
ago,
to you,
even,
you have to have
even
them.
Two
it's
years
mandatory.
Ago,
yeah.
Right. Ukraine has been making offensives without air support, without having a good field artillery support. Okay, it's like
that's right.
Field artillery does two things. One, there's what you call preparatory fires. And that's where you try to kill as many and disrupt as many enemy before you as possible. And then you have follow-on suppressive fires. You're going to keep those suppressive fires up as your men are attacking. And as you run into their flanks, then you shift that artillery away so you don't kill your own troops. But you still keep up the pressure on the enemy. Ukraine cannot do that. It does not have the capability to do that. Now you see Russia advancing, okay? When Russia advances, they have air support. They have field artillery support. They have preparatory fires. They have suppressive fires. They have all these things, okay? So when you look at Ukraine attacking the Russian front, okay, yes, they lose about 10 men for every Russian that they kill. That's very realistic, okay? But now when you look at Russia attacking the Ukrainian things, it's not 10 to 1. It is not, because Russia has the fire support and the air support that the Ukrainians do not have. And that's how you reduce casualties. You reduce them with this fire support. It's like in World War I, everybody just runs across the field and get shot down by the enemy. That would be the Ukrainians. But the Russians, when they attack, they're going to have suppressive fire, preparatory fires, fire support, air support. Okay, so they're not going to take as many casualties as the Ukrainians are going to talk about. Listen, there's so much lying going on about this, okay, that there's no news that's really good. I mean, there's History Legends, Weave Union, and another military summary. What they show on there is fairly accurate, okay, what they describe, okay? So any Western press does not. But I want you to go back to the Egyptian empires, go back to the Babylonian empires, to the Assyrian empire. Every empire always did the same thing. The Egyptian pharaoh would have these big poems written about these great victories that he won at this place or that place, like at Kadesh or something, okay? The fact is, there was no great victory. He just told his people that he was the greatest pharaoh, and he had this great victory. We do the same thing today. The Egyptians did it, the Babylonians did it, the Assyrians did it, the Greeks did it, the Romans did it. Everybody does it. They're all lying to their people, saying that they've done great and wonderful things, okay? Because it's easier to say that you've done great and wonderful things than it is to actually do them. Actually doing them is quite painful, okay? So just keep this in mind. Like they say, the first casualty of war is the truth. That they really mean it when they say that.
You bet.
So yeah. I hope this just gives people some perspective and stuff, okay? And your leaders are never going to tell you what I just told you. They're never going to tell you that, okay? But go to somebody who's a serious student of strategy, tactics, and war, and who really understands this would be a combat arms officer that's had to do it, okay, had to plan it, had to do it. Go talk to them, and they can see what's going on over there. It's very apparent. Okay. So anyways, let me continue. Last week, I'm discussing surviving my life. Okay, and I hope that in discussing these things, I'm trying to give lessons about how to survive. Okay, and this is my survival experiences. Okay, so last week when we left off, I had been tasked, just me alone, to stop all these armed robberies of gay people at gay bars. Okay, and this was like several square miles of gay bars on East Kennedy Boulevard in Tampa, Florida. Okay, spread over several miles, so it's really difficult for one person to do it. Difficult, but not impossible. Okay, so a few months later, the city council asked the chief of police to clean all the homeless people out of the area north of downtown so they could gentrify it. Cities do this all the time. The same lieutenant called me in to see if he could make me feel in this task also. He gave me another cop to work with me and told us to do it. He did not need to know how, but they did not want to find a bunch of dead bodies floating in the river. So anything short of just killing them all, okay, is what they said, okay? So that was all the directions we got. The other cop was Paul Truesdale, and he was from my police academy class. Paul had been a Milwaukee police officer before he came to Tampa. We went to the park to brainstorm. We considered the culture of the homeless. Now, this is things that you need to do when you've got a problem. Consider the culture of the homeless. If we arrested them, they would just go back downtown when they got out a few days later. There was a flop house that they sometimes used that had an address and a phone number. If we put that down as their address, we could write them a notice to appear instead of booking them. We would then tell them that they had to appear in court at the appointed time or a warrant would be issued for their arrests in Hillsborough County. Okay? In other words, we put emphasis on the county. They asked what would happen if they were in a different county, and we told them nothing, because the warrant was just good in this county. We knew it was in their nature to just move on. We arrested them for all the minor misdemeanors that people normally commit in their daily life. we would arrest dozens of guys at the same time. Pretty soon, the streets were empty of people. Only one guy came back. He had gone to Miami, but Miami bought him a bus ticket back to Tampa. We had our methods, and the Miami police had theirs. We told him we would cut him a break, and he could hitchhike over to the next county. We accomplished our mission because we used the social terrain and homeless culture to our advantage. In the process, we made dozens of felony arrests on outstanding warrants. When people are on the lam, they will often try to hide in the homeless community. We captured many murderers, rapists, and child molesters. This is who is out there on the streets right now. They are not all victims. Many of those people you see in homeless camps are predators. They are very bad people, okay? So don't listen to the Democrats, okay, that, oh, these are just poor, innocent people. No. Many of them are out there because they're horrible people. They're murderers, rapists, child molesters, robbers.
How common is murder now? You just don't hear about it on the nightly news. You don't even read about it in the alt news much. Murder rates. It's just an FBI statistic. How common are murders? Take a city like Tampa. How common do these life-ending events happen?
Well, they're very common. They're very common. I mean, listen, most murders are between people that know each other. Okay, and then there's murders of just people who are incident to a robbery or a rape or something. They go ahead
wrong
and kill
them. Wrong place at the wrong time. Yeah, right.
So they're common.
Right.
You know, there's nothing done to stop it, really. So When I was in my field training program, my sergeant, Stephen Hogue, made an address that I was involved in. When we went to court, the criminals remarked to us that they could not believe I was a cop. The sergeant told me that the other cops also found it hard to believe. I just did not have the demeanor of a cop. My demeanor was more akin to the criminals. In view of what I have said about myself up to this point, it is not hard to imagine. In fact, I was very comfortable around bad people. I did not fear them because I knew them and their ilk. I could think like they thought, and I could read them. I could anticipate what they were going to do. After a year in patrol division, they asked Sergeant Hogue to set up a plainclothes street anti-crime squad to do mugging decoy work and just basically go out at night and make the streets unsafe for criminals. They wanted him to select veteran cops for the work. A veteran cop has 5 years on the street. Sergeant Hogue insisted on picking me. He told the press that nobody ever figured me for a cop, not even other cops. I did not have to act to fit in on the street, in the street life. I could just do it naturally. In fact, it was not new to me. I had been there and done that in New Orleans, Chicago, St. Louis, Houston, Phoenix, and Los Angeles. This work was very proactive and ultra-violent. We saturated the worst parts of the city to be predators on the predators. We did mugging decoy work because it took a lot of muggers off the street. I would often be the decoy because I did not give up off cop vibes. Sometimes I would get mugged 10 times in a single night. The way we worked was that the plainclothes cops would be dressed like bums and slowly filter into the target area. First, all 9 backup cops filtered in, then the decoy would come into the area. When somebody mugged the decoy, the backup would rush in and arrest the criminal as he walked away. Sometimes people would hit me, sometimes they would pull a knife on me, and sometimes they would pull a gun on me. It cannot get more dangerous than this. The life was short, mean, and brutal. Most people do not make it very long. One night, I saw just how effective this work was. We set up on Skid Row. I was the first cop in, and I sat on a bus bench across the street from a couple of Skid Row bars. A big black guy came and sat on the same bench. A wino left one bar headed to another, and the black guy put his arm out as if to stop me. He said, "That's a cop, brother. I know he looks like an easy mark, but if you roll him, you will get busted." In fact, I was the only cop around for at least a mile. I thanked him for letting me know. He was disgusted at how a guy could not make a decent living on the streets anymore. Unwittingly, he was helping us do our work by spreading the word.
Uh-huh.
Politicians hate this work because both cops and criminals often end up getting hurt. They do not have enough sense to realize that if you want to catch violent criminals, you need to go out and hang with them. The violence will occur whether the cops are there or not. But politicians do not care about people. They only care about themselves and their image. So after a year, they sent me to Vice Prostitution. This work is still out on the streets in the worst part of town. It is integral to what they call the life. Pimps, hookers, and vice cops are all players in the life. Your instincts must be solid if you're going to survive the life. Vice is the unit where many cops lose their way and end up losing their life or their job. It is almost always violent, and you will be doing a lot of fighting on your own without backup. You must handle whatever may come. Hookers are afraid that you might be rough trade or a serial killer, so they will often fight violently when you try to arrest them. They will pull straight razors, ice picks, knives, guns, or razor blades on you. They will bite you, try to scratch out your eyes and pull your hair. Sometimes they kill their johns. Sometimes they try to rob them. And sometimes their johns rob them and kill them. It is the law of the jungle. You cannot get distracted or become complacent. In my fourth year, the serial killer Bobby Joe Long started killing hookers and dumping their bodies in the countryside outside of Tampa. They moved us vice cops over to the Homicide Bureau to help catch him because we knew the hookers and we knew the streets. Tampa Police Department, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, Florida State Police, and the FBI all formed a task force to catch him. It was a lot of surveillance work. We caught him after 9 months of work. Then I had to put on a suit and work homicide cases during the day. It includes everything from simple assault to capital murder. It is tedious and boring work. It is reactive police work. I asked to go back to the tactical division so I could get back into plainclothes work again. Plainclothes work is proactive police work, not reactive. I worked in organized crime when I got back. We worked on a prostitution racketeering case for the next year. This is also tedious work. Me and my partner, Cindy Reedy, would come in at 5 a.m. and take out a pickup truck to collect our suspect's trash before the garbage truck came. Then we spread out the trash on plastic sheets in the basement and sifted through it for evidence. We did a lot of surveillance on the suspects, including telephone tolls, pen registers, and mail cover.
Uh-huh.
All the little pieces of evidence add up. The little things get criminals caught. We arrested over 22 people on racketeering charges in that case, okay? So when I first went on Tampa Police Department, I joined the Florida National Guard as a sergeant in the infantry. I took the infantry NCO basic course to get up to speed. I got promoted to staff sergeant, then went to officer candidate school. I graduated number one from OCS. I was commissioned a lieutenant in the Armored Cavalry. The cavalry is basically a reconnaissance. It is like infantry on steroids. It is about aggressiveness. It is about showing no mercy. I was an armored cavalry officer for the next 14 years. I loved it. In my 28 years in the regular army, in the National Guard, and as an Army Reserve officer, I traveled to 36 different countries and went to a total of 16 different conflict zones. I also signed a non-disclosure agreement. If you want to go, you must keep it to yourself. I graduated from the Armored Cavalry's Officer Basic Course, the Armored Officer's Advanced Course, and I attended the Combined Arms and Services Staff School and the Military Intelligence Staff Officers Course at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I volunteered to attend as many schools as I could. I went to the Jungle Warfare School at Fort Sherman, Panama. I attended the Security Manager's Course, the Communications Security Course at Fort Gordon, Georgia, the Tank Commander's Course at Gowan Field, Idaho, the Infantry Mortar Platoon Officer's Course at Fort Benning, and even took the Psychological Warfare Operations Course. I not only liked the physical adventure, I loved intellectual adventure. Also, information is not just the key to survival, it is essential to intellectual and spiritual freedom. In civilian life, I finished a bachelor's degree in political science, history, economics, and international relations. I took every advanced course that the police department offered. I was such an information and training hound that my fellow cops would make fun of me for it. But I believed in the Red Army Marshal Tukhachevsky's dictum that training hard, battle easy. After I graduated from Memphis State University in 1979, I went to graduate school. All I needed to complete my master's degree was to write a dissertation and defend it. I had fun in the police department, but I had to quit to return to Memphis State and complete my master's. My master's thesis was on pioneer agriculture in Guatemala and Costa Rica. It was a geography degree. So
that's an interesting way to get it. I wouldn't think you'd be a geography type, but yeah, more of a sociology type. Interesting.
Well, it was about tropical agriculture. So the thesis had a lot to do with the terrain, the environment, the jungle, the soils, all that kind of
sure.
stuff. So it was very much a geography thing. So.
Gotcha.
While in patrol division, I made friends with a customs patrol officer named Butcher Zur. We patrolled the same beach in South Tampa and would talk. When I was working organized crime, I went to St. Petersburg as a backup on a 1 kilo of cocaine buy bust. Since it was out of our jurisdiction, the St. Petersburg Police Department, Vice Narcotics, had detectives working the case. I would see them about once a month at the Pinellas County Courthouse for depositions after we made the arrest. These two detectives, James Taman and Jeff Berner, left the St. Petersburg Police Department around the same time that I left the Tampa Police Department, and they took federal jobs. Taman went to U.S. Customs, and Berner went to DAA. I finished my master's thesis, which was a comparative study of agriculture in Guatemala and Costa Rica. Then I got a job setting up orange plantations in Belize to take advantage of Reagan's Caribbean Basin initiative. I checked in with the military attaché in Belize City, and I got to work. I ended up having to leave Belize in a hurry because I fell afoul of the Belizean Security and Intelligence Service. All I did was my job. I had found out that aircraft were flying cocaine into Belize to the orange plantation where I worked. A plane from the United States would fly guns and ammunition south to the same place and trade them for cocaine, which went to Florida. The guns and ammo would go to El Salvador to the FMLN Marxist guerrillas. I heard the planes and observed them coming in. I flew to Florida and told the owner of the orange plantation because it was his property. He asked me to tell everyone in the area about it. In fact, I never said a word, anything about it except to him. When I returned to Belize, the airplane stopped. This told me that the plantation owner was involved. I thought it was just a bunch of criminals taking advantage of the war.
Yes.
I went to Belize City and told the military attaché. He was a special forces colonel, and we had mutual military officer friends. I had a good network of people in Belize that I spoke with often. It was a small country. I had friends up to the minister level. I started hearing that the SIS had a hit on me. I decided to leave Belize. At this point, I figured that I had outed an operation that corrupt Belizean officials were involved in, and they put the SIS up to eliminating me.
Goes too high.
I assumed the plantation owner told his Belizean government co-conspirators. On my way out, I stopped in Belize City to talk to the military attaché so I could sign out with him and let him know I was leaving the country. He told me to give him a call when I arrived at the border city of Corozal. When me and my wife walked out of the embassy, I told her that it was strange that he wanted me to call just before I left the country.
Uh-huh.
No military attaché anywhere had ever asked me to do that. Even my wife was creeped out by the unusual suggestion. I began thinking that maybe the military attaché had talked to the Belizean SIS and they would hit me at the border. I did not call. I heard from friends in Belize that 2 weeks after I left, the colonel and his 5-year-old granddaughter died from drowning in Belize Harbor in 3 feet of water. The colonel was in excellent shape, and I found that an accident would have been highly unlikely.
Right.
On a trip back to the States a few months later, I met with military contacts in Miami that told me that it was the CIA that was running the guns into El Salvador because because the Soviet Union could not afford to. To control the government in El Salvador, they needed the FMLN, Marxist guerrillas, to be a threat to the government so they could protect them. Listen, this is why ISIS was created. ISIS, the U.S. government protects the world from ISIS, okay? But we control them. This thing that happened to me in Belize and El Salvador was the same thing. It was the CIA that had the SIS try to whack me. I asked why. I was not an investigator for a reporter. No. I was just doing my job by reporting this to the military attaché. I had not reported it to anyone else. The colonel was killed because he failed to set me up for elimination. I moved to Costa Rica to set up orange plantations. Once again, I got involved in Nicaragua. I had befriended Bruce Jones, who was also in the orange business and was also involved with FDN Contras in Nicaragua. Specifically, he was helping Aiden Pastora of the ARDE Southern Front Contras. I admired Aiden Pastora. In 1978, he successfully took the Nicaraguan Congress hostage and successfully exchanged them for prisoners that he wanted free. He was called Comandante Cero. Pastora turned against the Sandinistas because he was not a Marxist. He opened the southern front of the anti-Marxist Contras. Bruce Jones helped him and fought in the field with him. Bruce Jones was a very stand-up guy. When they hauled him in front of a judge, he threatened him with jail if he did not reveal who helped him help the Contras. Bruce just said, and I quote, "I have been working very hard. I am exhausted trying to feed my 8 children. Put me in jail and give me a rest, and you take care of my kids." He called their bluff. They just let him go.
Interesting. So, wow. Speaking of cocaine, I've just done a search. How many pounds of cocaine are smuggled into the U.S. every year? Google won't give me an answer. It says an AI overview of that question is not available for this search. So they won't even put a number up there.
There's probably about 50 metric tons that come in, maybe more. As the price goes down...
Well, you mentioned 1 kilo, and that's not even a drop in the bucket. That's nothing.
No, that was a city police department. That was nothing, okay? So once I got settled in Costa Rica, I flew back to Tampa. I went to my parents' house. My mom was complaining about the guy across the canal from their house that had a big cigarette boat and would go out late at night. She thought he was smuggling drugs. She asked me to contact my U.S. Customs buddy, Butcher Zur. I dropped by his office, not because I think he could do anything about it, but because my mom asked me to. The guy was named Oba Chandler, and he was a snitch for U.S. Customs, and he was a serial killer. Butch took me to his house, and we had drinks. He was an affable guy, but I thought he seemed like an empty person, sort of soulless. I was not going to trust him. I told my mom that Customs were on it, but I did not tell her that he was a snitch. Okay,
wow.
So secrets are secrets, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So in 1989, Chandler met Joan Rogers, who was on vacation with her 2 daughters from Ohio, and offered to take them on a boat ride out into Tampa Bay. When he got them out there, he raped them and murdered them. He was executed in 2011 for this crime. Now, they figure he had killed about 7 other women in the Florida area, South Florida area. However, this trip to Butch's office was seminal. While I was in Costa Rica, Cayman and another customs special agent named William Cancio had set up a dummy import-export company called Maya Import-Export. A Colombian national named Humberto Kiko Renteria was interested in buying the company to smuggle cocaine through it from Colombia. U.S. Customs wanted to contract me to join the company to open a subsidiary in Costa Rica and sell it to the Cali cartel in Colombia. I had a pre-existing beef with the Cali cartel. They had a policy of first killing the children of the people they betrayed them or ripped them off before they killed the people. In New York, they went after a couple. They took their 2 kids to a night care center in Queens so they could go out and party. There were 10 children in that night care center and 3 women watching them. Cali cartel sicarios murdered all the kids and the women. I would like to think that I did it for the kids. I agreed to work with him. I had worked with James Tannen before when we were city cops. They knew that I already knew how to do undercover investigations, so it would be seamless. If any investigation involves drugs from overseas, the DEA must be involved. That it was Jim Tannen's old partner from St. Petersburg Police Department, Jeff Bruner, made things even easier. This was not our first rodeo together. Kiko Renteria knew the bosses in the Cali cartel, especially the chief operating officer, Miguel Rodriguez Orihuela. He decided to pitch the cartel buying Maya import-export and shipping 1,000 kilos of cocaine per month through Costa Rica to Florida. That would be $15 million in cocaine wholesale and $100 million retail per month. Over $1 billion worth of cocaine per year could be trafficked through this one company. This was a major acquisition, and this is how the U.S. Treasury Department could infiltrate all the way to the top of the Cali cartel and make a deal with the drug lords personally. It was a major acquisition and a major new route to shipping cocaine into the United States. So, of course, the big boss would want to talk to me. Cali drug lord Miguel Angel Rodriguez Orihuela had a reputation for micromanagement. The problem was the drug lords would want to speak to a full partner, and the federal government could not send an employee to do that job because it was a suicide mission. So Colombia was a lawless mess. The Marxist guerrillas of the FARC and ELN were fighting the Colombian government, and private paramilitary groups paid for by ranchers and businesses were hunting down the Marxist guerrillas and their families and executing them. The drug cartels were at war.
Question.
Yes.
Question. Trump is talking about declaring the cartels to be terrorist organizations, which is suggestive of a potential military angle to his words. I don't know. Any chance that the U.S. could go in to this this cartel country and really take them down? Is that possible?
Well, listen, what the suggestion is it demonstrates Trump's total ignorance of history. He has no concept of history at all. Mexico's big beef is with the United States. Remember, we stole half of Mexico from Mexico. Mexico is not going to be happy with us invading them again.
No, every Mexican
will be out there with a rifle fighting us.
Wow.
It will not be an easy thing to do. It's a very
You have to conquer the whole country practically, and going to war with Mexico is, you know, not easy.
It's on our border. What do you think all the fifth columnist cartel people in the United States are going to do? As we attack and kill Mexican people, they will be murdering American people in America.
It'll backfire.
It'll be
big
a mess.
Time.
Yes, it will. So the drug cartels were at war with each other. The Medellin cartel blew up an airliner full of people just to kill one Cali cartel member, and the Cali cartel blew up an apartment building in Medellin to try and kill Pablo Escobar. The Cali cartel created a terrorist organization called Los Pepes to attack the Medellin cartel. Then they joined up with all the other cartels to jump on the Medellin cartel. The cartels kidnapped people. The Marxist guerrillas kidnapped people, and independent kidnapping gangs took advantage of the lawlessness to start a plague of kidnapping. If you were kidnapped, there was a 70% chance that you would not survive. Even if the ransom was paid, they would kill you anyways. The drug cartels and businessmen joined forces to create an armed force called MAS, which was Muerte a los Secuestradores, which means death to the kidnappers. They hunted down kidnappers and executed them. Because of the climate of lawlessness and anarchy, the common criminals attacked people anywhere they could at any time of day. The Cali cartel was tired of the common criminals and called them disponibles, or disposables. Cali sicarios went out at night and hunted common criminals down and executed them. They were generally handcuffed, plastic bag put over their head, shot in the head, and dumped in the river. There were so many executions that the Cauca River was jammed with dead bodies. If somebody robbed you, they would just kill you, even if you cooperated with them. Put simply, Colombia was not a safe place to be. not even for Colombians. The U.S. government was not going to allow an employee to go there. That is why they contracted me to do the job. I had undercover experience. I worked in the life, so I had street smarts. I'd worked organized crime investigations, and I spoke Spanish. I had also worked with the key players from the DEA and U.S. Customs Agents when they were vice cops. I already lived in Costa Rica. They flew me up to Tampa on my birthday, and on the day that the Colombian government assassinated opposition presidential candidate Luis Carlos Galán, it was the cartel that told me that the government did it. And I believe them. I believe the government did do it. Like I said, there was no law in Colombia. I agreed to do it only if I could do it without any country clearance. If you are an American working for law enforcement in another country, you must get country clearance from that country. If you do not, it is called espionage, and you will go to prison for a long time. If you do not have country clearance, you are called a cutout, because our government could deny any connection with you if something went wrong. In this case, I thought there was far more danger to me if any government official in Colombia knew about me because of the corruption was so flagrant. Cutouts usually get paid more also. I was going to have to go to Colombia on my own without any backup at all. No DEA SWAT team, no SEAL Team 6 or Delta Force to sweep in and get me out of a jam. Nobody at all. I thought it was safer that way. My best friends thought I was insane. Maybe, but I thought it would be exciting. First, I had to set up a subsidiary import-export company in San Jose, Costa Rica, and put a lawyer and accountant on retainer to swear to any lie that I wanted to tell the Cali cartel. Of course, they thought I was a genuine bad guy, and they were willing to do whatever it took to make good money from cocaine trafficking. They stood to make hundreds of thousands of dollars from a few hours' work. My first trip down to Cali in February 1990 was just to make the deal to sell the company to the Cali cartel for $300,000 and negotiate a percentage of each load that we smuggled to Florida. The operation was very low-key. They picked me and Kiko up at up in a car because they did not want all kinds of cars driving up to the apartment. Only the same car would come and go. They had unarmed Huachimal, or guard, in the garage. He never came inside. He was always in the garage as lookout. Yes, just one old man. They were all about not attracting attention to themselves. There were three sicarios, hitmen, in the apartment with Miguel. These guys had to wear nice clothes and have manners. Only one had a gun. I had seven knives on me that would be hard to find, and I had smuggled a .32 caliber zip gun on the plane with me. The Colombians were searching everyone thoroughly because of the airliner blowing up in the drug war. They searched me good and with a metal detector, but found nothing. I must thank Captain
What's a zip gun? A zip gun for our audience.
It was an army little handheld army flare gun, and it uses a spring-loaded thing to shoot a cartridge that has a flare in it. So I just took the flare out and honed it out so I could fit a .32 caliber bullet in there.
Got it.
And then I release the spring and it shoots the bullet.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So I must thank Captain Brannigan of Tampa Police Department for that, because he was a master of hiding weapons. He would give us classes where we would all come up and search him for weapons, and we would find four or five. After we told him that we were satisfied that he was unarmed, he would pull out two dozen more weapons out that he had hidden, and we could not find. Often in my plain clothes work, the bad guys would search me. Sometimes cops would mistake me for a bad guy and search me. I was searched dozens of times over the years, and neither the bad guys nor the cops ever found my pistol. I carried a Colt 1911 automatic 45 caliber pistol.
I'm not going to ask where you hid it, for God's sakes, but that's quite a story. Never mind.
Well, let me tell you, I feel like I shouldn't tell anybody where I hid it because
Okay. Leave it quiet. That's fine.
Yeah, because I still carry it there. Okay,
gotcha.
So while in Cali, Colombia, I had to constantly assess the situation when I was in a room or in a car with the sicarios. As soon as I walked into the room, I had to figure out my escape route if things broke bad. I had to prioritize who I was going to shoot. I only had one shot, and who I was going to stab. Of course, I would shoot the Sicario with the gun first and try to get a hold of it to use on the others. At every moment in Cali, in a room or in a car, I had to constantly plan how I was going to kill everyone and escape. Slashing the eyes of the driver of the car I was in was probably one. Then, in the ensuing chaos, I needed to start taking out each person in the order of who was the most threat to me first, and so on. This was like tank gunnery in the armored cavalry. You prioritize who you're going to shoot based on the level and immediacy of the threat that they pose to you.
Mitch, excuse me. This is a major motion picture. If anyone's listening with ties to Hollywood and you want a great plot line, you just heard it, and there's more to come. This man is certainly Class A material for a leading role in a major film about this whole world of drugs and death and how worthless human life is to these people. Go ahead.
So if I had to escape, I already memorized the phone number of an expert human smuggler. I would tell him nothing. He was on a retainer and would be paid $250,000 if he got me safely to Ecuador. That's all he needed to know. He did not need to know anything except that everyone was looking for me. He was not a friendly. He was a very crafty and professional criminal that assumed other bad guys were paying him. Actually, it was the U.S. Embassy that was going to pay him the $250,000.
Yeah.
But he didn't know that. He had no idea. So he agreed to do it, though. He said, I could use the business, So mindset is everything. These drug lords and their sicarios are the most violent and dangerous men on earth. What gave me an edge was that their lives were in mortal danger with me around. I was a threat to them, not the other way around.
Sound at least as inhuman as the Jews engaged in genocide in Gaza and the West Bank. These are psychopaths. They're not human beings by our standards.
Right. Money comes before humanity. Definitely. So, I fully intended to just kill all of them if the opportunity presented itself. I was not thinking about how to defend myself. I was thinking about how to go on the offensive. I was thinking about how I would kill them all. In each moment, they were in different positions and doing different things, so in each moment, I was recalibrating my attack plan.
Wow.
An attack plan must be for an organic, living, evolving plan. Like any natural predator, I would only attack if I had a chance of succeeding. The objective was homicide, not suicide. I was not impulsive, but calculated. I simply had to be colder and more vicious than they were. And listen, when I say that I was thinking about killing them, actually what I wanted to do was to kill them. That was my intention. My intention was genuinely to kill every last one of them. Okay. If I had an opportunity, I was going to kill them. Now, I didn't tell the U.S. government that I was going to kill them all, okay, but I was just going to kill them all. I mean, what difference would it make?
That's the moral high ground.
They're not going to extradite me to Colombia for it, right?
No.
So Miguel was in with another businessman, so I had to wait in the living room with the Sicarios. They were polite and offered me a local soda called the Popular, which is like a cream soda. They then started showing me a newspaper that had a picture with a dead man and woman that had been executed and thrown along the bank of the river. They were talking about how the woman would lure men into a dark alley, then they would kill him and rob him. I think they may have been talking about this to intimidate me. They asked me what I thought, and I said, good job. After a while, they finally relaxed around me. In my travels and on the street, I had learned to never let the other people around me determine if I belonged somewhere or not. I always decided that. I knew that eventually people would get used to me.
Speaking Spanish or English to these people?
Spanish. Everything's in Spanish. Only one guy spoke English, and that was Kiko. the guy from Florida.
Yeah.
Then I went with Kiko to negotiate the deal with Miguel, the drug lord. Miguel was on the phone talking to a guy in Mexico. They were about to move 50 metric tons of cocaine through a tunnel into the United States. That's 50,000 kilograms in one shot.
That's 100,000, over 100,000 pounds.
Yeah, 100,000 pounds in one shot. Kiko told me that if I was not clear about what Miguel told me, I could ask him in English to clarify it. Miguel was an educated and polite man. He drove a hard bargain. We asked for 4% of each load, but he did some calculating and offered 2%. He explained that he wanted it to be regular and long-standing business, and he was afraid that if we got too much money too fast, we would attract attention to ourselves.
Okay.
He said that at 2%, James, Willie, and I would get $100,000 per month each. He said that we should not go crazy buying things. He would pay $300,000 for the company after the first load made it through. I agreed to his terms. Of course I would. There was no business unless he approved the deal. Beggars can't be choosy, even in drug deals. Only a cop would demand more. Then he asked me in Spanish, ¿Trabaje por la DEA o la CIA? If I was the honest businessman that I portrayed, I should not know what that meant. I looked at Kiko. Kiko said, la DEA is the DEA and la CIA is the CIA. I honestly said no. In fact, I was working for the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Miguel then told me that it was a Cali cartel policy that if anybody betrayed the cartel, they would kill all their children first so that the traitors would know they were responsible for their children's death before they went to hell.
Jeez.
I was not shocked or disturbed because I already knew that. That I was not disturbed was just one more proof that I had no intentions of betrayal. I acted as if that did not apply to me. Then he told me that the Cali drug cartel had a drug-free workplace policy and did not allow any of his employees to use the product. It was a very wise policy. I knew his workers violated it, but that is how I could build trust with them. I did not tell him he was surrounded by a bunch of cokeheads. It only cost $2 for a pure gram on the street in Colombia. Everybody was using it. It was on sale. So after concluding the deal, we went out into the living room, and Miguel said that he was going to call Mr. Rada in Panama to come up and check out my company in San Jose. And the next minute, the Cali cartel made its fatal mistake. When Miguel called Mr. Rada in Panama, he was not home. His wife answered. Miguel gave him his phone number to call back, and I memorized it. International calls, of course, are tracked, and this put me in Miguel's home at that time and date. It was that telephone record that convicted him of drug trafficking. He could not argue that away. In crime, it is the little things that will get you caught, and there are a million little things going on in a crime.
What did they do with him, punishment-wise? What happened?
Well, for the deal that I made with him, he got 27 years in Colombian prison for that. So we'll stop here for tonight.
This is a major motion picture. Mitchell, this is a major motion picture. And I really appreciate you sharing this. Listening to the small details is fascinating. The guy's in the joint for 27 years. Did you get his sentence reduced somehow? Did you bargain it down for him?
No, when he went to jail in Colombia, I'll get to this later, but when he went to jail in Colombia, they used my case to put him in jail in Colombia.
Are you considered untouchable? Will they stay away from you now?
I don't know. If they had an opportunity, they would kill me and wipe out my family.
God. These are
for Colombians, revenge is a dish best served cold. Colombians are very vengeful people. They will never let it go.
What is this gang up here? Tren de Agua? Aragua? Tren de Agua?
Yeah, that's
Aragua.
A Venezuelan gang.
It's Venezuela?
They're just a street gang. gang is all there. They're not. They're a street gang. They do robberies, purse snatchings, stuff like that. They're petty criminals, basically.
Right. Last quick question. At this point, after watching Trump mince words and change his stories, what do you think he's really going to do about this mass deportation thing? Just give me 15, 20 seconds. Is he going to try and do it? 30 million people?
He can deport 1.8 million right away because they already have orders of deportation. They just have to pick him up, put him on the plane, and they go.
They've been arrested.
There's no appeal. There's no appeal or nothing. They're deported.
Might he not claim victory at that point and kind of slow down on the rest of it?
Well, of course, you know. I mean, you got to realize, he says he's going to build a wall, but, you know, it's not up to Trump to build the wall. Congress
has
to authorize the money.
That's
do you think Congress
government.
Is going to give him the money to do it?
No. That's his out. It's not going to happen.
If they give him the money, he will do it. There's no doubt in my mind.
I don't think Congress
will do it if he gets the money. But
everybody but a handful.
Everybody
in Congress has an AIPAC babysitter, ADL babysitter, whatever.
We
know that. Mitchell, thank you. That was an extraordinary hour, as was the last visit. They all are. So we'll look forward to our next talk. It's a great story, and it's real. Thank you. Terrific.
Okay, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay, my friend. Mitchell Henderson, what a life. That he's still alive in and of itself is remarkable. What survival instincts he has. Okay, gang, back with you tomorrow, Tuesday. Talk to you in 21 hours.